From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Elijah Cummings, wrote in a memo today that he is planning to issue a subpoena to the White House on Friday for documents related to the impeachment inquiry. Cummings wrote that the subpoena comes after the committee has tried several times to get documents voluntarily from the White House. In a press conference today, Adam Schiff, who's chair of the House Intelligence Committee, warned the administration against stonewalling.
We want to make it abundantly clear that any effort by the secretary, by the president, or anyone else to interfere with the Congress's ability to call before it relevant witnesses will be considered as evidence of obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress.
Joining us now is Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Jeremy.
And before we get to the latest on impeachment, I want to get to some breaking news today in the political world from the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders, who is running for president. He has been hospitalized after chest pain, had two stents inserted. What's the latest on how he's doing, and what does this mean for his campaign?
Yeah, you know, it came as a surprise to a lot of people because Senator Sanders hasn't really had a history of heart issues, and this certainly is sidelining him from the campaign at this point. Of course, people hope that he gets better quickly and can be back on the campaign trail, but it's stalling his campaign at this point. They say that he's not going to be returning to campaign activity until he's better and until he has fully recovered.
Okay, we'll keep watching that story. On the impeachment inquiry, Congressman Adam Schiff said he's concerned about stonewalling, as we just heard there. What can we expect now with the subpoena coming to the White House?
Well, I thought it was fascinating listening to Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, and Adam Schiff, who now has sort of emerged as the face of this impeachment inquiry, given that it's going through the Intelligence Committee, that they had such a tremendous sense of urgency about this, that the idea that they're going to drag this out over several months, go through litigation and through courts based on not getting documents, for example, from the administration or not letting people testify. What Adam Schiff said is that if the Trump administration decides not to turn over documents, decides not to allow people to testify, that they will add that into the articles of impeachment, namely for obstruction.
That they could basically go forward with articles of impeachment just because they're not getting the documents that they need or the information that they need from the White House?
I think that would be what some prosecutors look at as a presumption of guilt, because you aren't turning in the information. If you're not handing over information to an investigator, then some prosecutors will take that as saying, well, see, that means that the person doesn't want you to see the thing that we're going for. But the real issue here is, this is not a legal proceeding, this is a political one, is that this is about Democrats not wanting this to drag out into 2020. They don't want this interfering with the Democratic primary any more than it already has. I mean, it's overshadowed the entire Democratic primary, and they certainly don't want this going through a lot of the primaries and elections heading into next year.
Okay, another big piece of news today on this whistleblower complaint. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's overseas, acknowledged that he was listening in on that July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's president. Here he is.
As for was I on the phone call, I was on the phone call. The phone call was in the context of, now I guess I've been the Secretary of State for coming on a year and a half. I know precisely what the American policy is with respect to Ukraine.
Okay, so he says he was on the call. Listen to him just speaking the other day with ABC's Martha Raddatz. This was before the release of the partial transcript of the call. And Raddatz asked Pompeo what he knew about the president pressuring Ukraine's leader on that call.
What do you know about those conversations?
So you just gave me a report about a IC whistleblower campaign, none of which I've seen.
None of which I've seen, but he was on the call. Domenico, what do you make of this latest tick?
Well, it certainly sounded like he was deflecting there on this week on ABC and hoping not to have to really get into the morass on this. But you know what? He was on that call. He apparently knew what was happening or heard what was happening. I don't know what his explanation is for that at this point, but I do find it fascinating. You know, he talks about how he's been in charge of the State Department for the last year and a half, And remember, before that, he was in charge of the CIA under this president. And where are the two areas where we seem to be seeing a lot of the, potential leaks and things that are coming out? We're seeing a lot of that from inside the intelligence community and at the State Department. Mm-hmm. So you wonder what his what the feelings are toward Mike Pompeo and how he ran both of those places. You know, we see some reporting with people feeling like they were glad to see him go from the CIA, and he's now at the State Department. And you have to wonder, at an agency that had been depleted at the top ranks, what that means for the people below and how much they're talking.
That is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks.
You're so welcome.
Let's bring in Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, there's so many details. Let's do a little government 101 recap here. The Constitution gives the House of Representatives the power to vote for impeachment, and the Senate serves as the court for impeachment trials. We're all wondering, what were the Founding Fathers' intentions when they included impeachment in the Constitution?
Well, that's unclear. And the ambiguity is one of the reasons it's this ongoing debate. It's clear that the preference was elections in terms of having a decision to remove presidents, but there is room in between. And some of the issues people talk about, the abuse of presidential power, the corruption of presidential decisions as a result of a foreign power, those are two that people glean would be relevant for Congress to act before the next election. But the ambiguity is at the heart of why this is such a political process.
And some of those reasons you describe fall under the specific descriptions of impeachable offenses, which are treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And the Constitution doesn't really define those terms. But how have they been defined in past impeachments?
Well, with presidents, we've seen impeachments that revolve around technical violations of the law, such as President Andrew Johnson. With Richard Nixon, we've seen impeachment that revolves around the obstruction of justice and the obstruction of an impeachment investigation. And with President Bill Clinton, we saw, again, violations of the law, perjury, as being the reason for moving forward. And then with senators and judges, there's been other reasons, again, from treasonous acts to secession, to much more.
You've said that the events moved very fast during President Nixon's inquiry in Watergate. How so?
Well, for a lot of the time, the public is not yet breaking toward supporting the removal of the president. The actual investigation is much longer. In 1973, the Senate conducts its own investigation. In 1974, the House Judiciary Committee starts impeachment proceedings. But it's not until really between March and July of 1974 that you see public support really break against the president, and Republican support start to break against the president as well. Mm-hmm. And it's a series of things that happen: the indictment of high-level officials, the release of first transcripts and then actual audio tapes of White House conversations that finally leads to the moment when Republicans tell President Nixon it's time to step down.
I'm thinking back to the Nixon impeachment process, or even Clinton, when we had just three news stations in our local paper. It's really harder now to control the political narrative, even given the country really is divided and the media landscape is so wide. Talk about your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, it works both ways for President Trump. On the one hand, the media is more partisan, so now he has conservative media outlets he will be able to rely on in the months ahead to provide supportive stories, to raise questions about the Democrats rather than the administration. And that works in his favor. But on the other hand, the news is simply harder to control. It comes out 24 hours a day in multiple outlets, and you don't even need to be a news organization to make news. So that's what we're seeing in the last few days, a cascading effect of stories about the abuse of power that become hard for a president to push back against.
Yeah, you mentioned the public sentiment during the Nixon impeachment inquiry. We're still more than a year away from the next presidential election. I mean, how astonishing would it be if we had an impeachment process playing out during the thick of the presidential campaign?
it would be unbelievable. It would create great instability in terms of how the parties think of what to do and who the candidate will even be. Mm-hmm. And it will affect public opinion. I think Speaker Pelosi is going to try to get a vote sooner than that and try to limit ultimately how much time this question is discussed before decisions are made by first the House and then the Senate. But this would not be just another campaign story. This will dominate the conversation about what the vote is about and who's best to hold office.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, and this week we bring you a portrait of Isabel Allende.
My job as a writer, as an activist, as a philanthropist, as a feminist, is to create awareness and to say, okay, this is what I see.
It's Latino USA from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
Henry Winkler is most famous for his acting. He played the Fonz in Happy Days back in the 70s, and now he plays Gene, the acting coach in HBO's Barry, for which he won an Emmy. But as he hits this second career peak, he's also writing children's books. His latest is called Alien Superstar, co-written with his longtime co-author, Hollywood producer Lynn Oliver. They join me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the main character in your book, we get a sense right at the beginning of what Buddy looks like. He has suction cups on the bottom of his feet, multiple eyes, and this appendage, a sensory enhancer coming out of his back and waving around. Where did this idea come from?
He comes from a red dwarf planet, which has low gravity. So we decided that he would need to have suction cups on his feet to hold them to the ground. And also, it's a dim planet. Red dwarf planets are dim. So he would need to have a lot of eyes in order to perceive the world around him. And the sensory enhancer is sort of the basic metaphor of the book, which is he comes from a repressive society where they're not supposed to experience any of the sensory joys of life, music, art, and so on. And so when they turn 13, their sensory enhancer is deactivated, which is what prompts the whole story of his flight to Earth.
But the sensory enhancer, he has really no control over. I mean, it gets him into a lot of trouble. Maybe it wants to look at an intriguing smell or something.
Right. And what it turned out to be was a buddy comedy, because you've got Buddy, who is this kind of wonderful young man who's looking at the world with wonder. And you've got his crazy friend, the enhancer, who does what he feels.
Something that kids can relate to, you think?
I think so.
Yeah, I think that children experience the world first through their senses. Their intellect comes much later. And not necessarily in a good way.
So when Buddy lands on Earth, he is mistaken for an actor, cast in a show as an alien, and becomes a star overnight. I have to ask both of you. Lynn, you're a producer. Henry, you're, of course, an actor. How likely is that? How often does that happen?
Well, I don't know. Do you believe in aliens landing on Earth?
Though, I mean, people becoming a star overnight with no real background in acting.
I left New York in September 18th, 1973. I had just made The Lords of Flatbush. I had $1,000 in my pocket. I could stay in Hollywood for 1 month. That was the length of time that $1,000 would take me. In the very first week, I got a part on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. It was four lines. They let me ad lib it to eight. In the second week, I auditioned for the Fonz.
Wow. And that 1974 Happy Days premiered.
Yes.
Did writing about Buddy bring you back to that moment?
Yes, but here it is. Lynn has written and produced at least 300 episodes of television and movies. We've written 35 books together.
Right.
I produce MacGyver. I'm an actor. I'm on a wonderful show called Barry.
Great show.
But we took our experience and we put a stranger in a strange land inside our experience.
Now, as you mentioned, Henry, you've both written many books together, although your previous books have been centered around a real kid, Hank, who has a real problem, which is dyslexia.
Right.
This one is complete fantasy. Why did you decide to go in this direction?
Well, you know, I have to say one of my favorite phrases, my mentor, Gary Marshall, always said, you know, a lot of people write important things. They make important television. I make Recess. And Lynn has always said to me, we want to be the book that is rolled up in somebody's back pocket or in their backpack that they are reading for pleasure and they don't feel the pressure. And then we have great underlying themes, body shaming, authenticity, don't judge a book by its cover, no pun intended, that underpin the comedy.
And it also felt like the world was ready for a real look at fame. You know, we live in a society where fame comes very quickly and easily and for no particular reason necessarily, you know, instant celebrity. And we think that that's held up as a value for kids. And so we thought it would be very interesting to write about fame and celebrity from all points of view, the advantages and the glamour and also the personal cost.
Do you find, I'm sure you hear from kids after they read your books, do you find that they're reading as much as they used to, given all of the devices that they have access to these days?
I will say, because I travel around the country, Lynn travels around the country, we travel together, separately, kids say two things to us. Wow, I laugh so hard. And two, how did you know me so well?
I find that kids, I do a lot of work with literacy and run a nonprofit organization of people who
what
write.
What's it called?
It's called the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. There are 30,000 members worldwide, and all the members are authors and illustrators of children's books. And we are all finding that kids are actually reading more, that the devices are one thing, and of course everyone is on their devices, but there has been a huge resurgence of reading among children. I think the predictions of the downfall of the printed book were premature and not true.
When I was a child, I was obsessed with Roald Dahl books.
Yeah,
what about each of you? Who was
good
your
taste.
Favorite? Who was your favorite, or what was your favorite book as a kid?
My parents read to me all the time until I was about 7 or 8 years old. They read poetry. They read classics. Then I started to read Charles Dickens, which I adored because I like big, fat sagas. And then I discovered A Tree Grows in Brooklyn and Marjorie Morningstar and sort of early literature that was aimed at girls and young women. And that was life transforming for me. Henry?
I read my first novel when I was 31. Because I am so dyslexic, I was so intimidated. My eye and the page never made friends. Now I read thrillers. Daniel Silva, the way he writes, it flows like a river in my brain. So that's my experience with him. And that I've written these books with Lynn is like one of the proudest moments of my life and one of the most unimaginable moments that it exists.
How do you learn your lines as an actor with your dyslexia?
I read my scripts over and over again. And what God giveth, you know, and God taketh away. So I can't read very well, but I can memorize pretty quickly. And if you want something, there is a way. You know, in my fan mail in 1975, I got a metal cutting that said, if you will it, it is not a dream. And I live by that concept. You want something, you can figure out how to do it. There is not one way.
We're talking about your book here, Alien Superstar, which is just coming out. But I have to ask you, Henry Winkler, as you've got this book coming out, you're the star of this show, Barry, which is you've won an Emmy for now.
Yes.
You know, you were just in the recent series of Arrested Development, which is a character, another Barry, Barry Zuckerkorn, that you've played.
Yes.
How does this feel right now in your career, especially compared to what you've been talking about back in the 1970s with Happy Days?
When I was lying in my bed in New York City in my apartment on West 78th Street, I dreamt of being an actor every moment. And now I am living it. And I'm a pretty verbal fellow. I have no words for the joy that courses through my body that I'm able to do this.
You know, when Henry and I first got together to do the Hank Zipser books, he always says it was during a lull in his career. So I'm grateful for the lull in your career, Henry. I'm sorry to say that.
Me too. I know. I am too now.
But we still met. So now there's not a lull in his career. So we have the books and our work together and his acting career. So to me, it's all a wonderful thing. I'm happy to see him happy. And I would just like to say that his memory, you know, you asked about his dyslexia and remembering the lines. When we sit down, we write together. We write in the same room, much like television comedy is done. You know, we have a writer's room, except it's just Henry and me.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry comes in, he can have been gone for 3 days and remembers exactly where we left off and what the last line is. So I see how he's compensated for whatever was a reading issue by having an incredible memory and feel for where we are in the story and what the lines are.
And we write every day. So we write from 10, we schmooze, and then we get down to work and we finish at about 12:30. Right now, we're in a studio in Los Angeles, and we're facing each other, which is exactly the way we work together. I sit on one side of Lynn's desk, and Lynn sits on the other at the computer, and we literally hammer out chapter after chapter that way.
And it sounds from the end, because there's a bit of a cliffhanger, that there is more coming for Buddy Berger.
We're in the middle of book two right this minute.
The concept is a trilogy, a three-book series.
But Hank started, we got the first contract that Lynn and I got for Hank Zipser was a contract for 4 novels, and they were going to see. And out of that came 28 books.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much to both of you for coming in and talking about your latest Alien Superstar, that is Henry Winkler and Lynn Oliver. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Jeremy.
This
is great
really exciting. Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Friends and family of the slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi today mark 1 year since he was killed at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Khashoggi was contributing columnist for the Washington Post and a critic of the Saudi government. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman denies he ordered the killing, but a CIA assessment found there's high confidence that he did. Joining us now is David Miliband, who's chief executive of the International Rescue Committee and former UK Foreign Secretary. Welcome back.
Thanks very much.
So you wrote on Twitter today that Khashoggi's killing has come to epitomize an age of impunity, not because it is isolated, but because it is symptomatic of a world without rules or accountability. What do you mean by that?
I mean that we're living through a time when more civilians are being killed in war than at any time since the end of the Cold War, that more aid workers are being targeted in the conduct of war in a way that is wholly contrary to international humanitarian law. And I mean that the perpetrators of these crimes are not being held accountable. And that leads to a cycle where more of the belligerents in conflicts around the world feel they can get away with anything, and so they therefore do anything, from chemical weapons to bombing coachloads of children to laying siege to towns and cities and starving the population.
As we said, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, denies that he ordered Khashoggi's killing. Here he is speaking last week with Nora O'Donnell on CBS's 60 Minutes.
How could you not know if this was carried out by people who are close to you?
Today, the investigations are being carried out. And once charges are proven against someone, regardless of their rank, it will be taken to court. No exception made.
Has there been any accountability for Khashoggi's murder in Saudi Arabia in the year since it's happened?
Well, the short answer to that is no. There are trials ongoing of some of those who are alleged to be involved. But obviously, the Khashoggi murder has come to epitomize this sense that opponents can be disposed of without remedy. And so the lack of remedy can only be seen as a sign of encouragement. And that's why I think it's so important that countries like the US take seriously their international responsibilities. We've seen Germany refuse to sell arms to Saudi Arabia that would be connected with the war in Yemen, which remains the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe, 24 million people in humanitarian need. And obviously there's an ongoing debate about how the Khashoggi murder can be held accountable. Our point is that it's right to do so, but also to recognize it's part of a wider syndrome, and that wider syndrome needs to be addressed.
Well, there were calls after Khashoggi's killing here in the United States for the U.S. to stop supporting Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen. Has that happened?
No, it hasn't, because although Congress did pass a very strong resolution condemning the war strategy, the failed war strategy in Yemen, the president twice vetoed the resolution that went through both the House of Representatives and the Senate. So there's unfinished business in respect of Yemen. And if there is to be any sense that Khashoggi's murder has been anything other than an appalling waste and an appalling crime, if there's no sense that there's no lesson for the war in Yemen, then really there's absolutely nothing to show for the year of protest that's been going on since the murder a year ago.
That is David Miliband, who is chief executive of the International Rescue Committee. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
This week, Senate Intelligence Committee members Mark Warner and Marco Rubio are calling on major tech companies like Facebook and YouTube to develop industry standards on how to deal with the rapid increase of deepfakes on their platforms. The term deepfakes refers to the process of using computers and machine learning software to manipulate videos and photos to make them seem real, even though they're not. This call to action comes just after a technology pioneer made a startling prediction recently during a conference at MIT. Hao Li, an associate professor at the University of Southern California's Institute for Creative Technologies, said he believes that in less than a year, we will all have the ability to produce our own deepfakes. Welcome, Hao.
Thanks for having me.
So just to give people a quick sense of what a deepfake may look like, I follow a page on Instagram where they post these funny mashups. And there was one that recently posted where it's comedian Tiffany Haddish on the face of singer Prince's body. And it really looks like she's singing. And of course, we've seen versions of this with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Now, you've said that we won't really see these very realistic depictions or the ability for us to use it until maybe 2 or 3 years from now. But recently, you changed that timeline. Tell us why.
Yeah, so I think the developments in computer graphics, computer vision, more specifically with all the boost in artificial intelligence, is really accelerating the development of specifically deepfake type of applications. And that's something we can see at various venues.
There was recently this app out of China, Zhao, I think
exactly.
is the name of it. You saw this application and you were like, oh my gosh.
We tried it instantly. One thing that in some ways impressed us was suddenly you can, you know, generate very, very convincing deepfakes out of a single picture. and also blend them inside, you know, videos, and they have high resolution results.
And but, we're talking regular folks with a phone and the app.
Exactly.
They're able to do this.
Exactly. So it's highly accessible to anyone.
Talk about the ramifications of an app like Zao with regular folks who now have an app and they're able to produce these deepfake videos and pictures.
I think in some ways, the first thing is like it's a little bit gimmicky, right? And there has been some regulations in place already for this specific app in China where very quickly, I think it was within a week or two, they instantly said you're not allowed to upload celebrities. They're adding features like facial recognition so that advanced these kind of features.
Right, because there were no safeguards in place of where these pictures and where these videos would go.
Exactly. And there are two specific problems. One of them is privacy and the other one is, you know, potential disinformation. But since they are curating the type of videos where you put your face into it, so in that case, disinformation isn't really the biggest concern.
Facebook recently announced it would make deepfake videos to create this data set to help stop the spread of deepfakes. That sounds like a great solution, but time is of the essence so that 6 to 12 months from now, there's not these bad actors who are just out there making these types of videos.
Right. Well, there is this. But on the other hand, there is also the other issue, which is, you know, the best possible algorithm will not be able to distinguish. So maybe we shouldn't really focus on detecting if they are deepfake or not, but we should maybe try to analyze what are the intentions of the videos.
Explain more on what you mean.
So first of all, not all the deepfakes are harmful. Non-harmful content are obviously for entertainment, for comedy or satire.
If it's clear to the person that it's comedy or satire.
If it's clear. And I think one thing that would help is it could be something that is based on AI or something that's data-driven that is capable of discerning if the purpose is not to harm people, right? And that's a mechanism that has to be put in place in domains where the spread of fake news could be the most damaging. And I believe that some of those are mostly in social media platforms.
What you're saying to someone who's a layman person is really the crux of many of the issues online when we're talking about fake news, for instance. Mm-hmm. Being able to find out and figure out the intent is a really hard thing to do.
Yes, but I think this is where the focus should be. And you don't really need deepfake videos to spread disinformation. I don't even think that deepfakes are the real threat. And in some ways, you know, by raising this awareness, by showing the capabilities, deepfakes are helping us to think about if things are real or not.
But it does add a deeper level of complexity. So deepfakes have already wreaked havoc, political havoc on mm-hmm. various parts of the world, including yeah. Malaysia. Back in June, the U.S. House Intelligence Committee held an open hearing on deepfakes.
Right.
And committee chair Adam Schiff said he doesn't think the U.S. is actually prepared for this technology. It's still very much something that the public doesn't understand or know on a deep level. So as we enter this political season, I mean, it's something really to be worried about.
Yeah, I agree. Right. So people have to know that these capabilities are possible. This is the same like when Photoshop was invented and it was never designed to deceive the public. It was designed for creative purposes. And if you have the ability to manipulate videos now, specifically targeting the identity of a person, it's important to create awareness. And that's sort of like the first step. The second step would be we have to be able to flag certain content. Flagging the content would be something that, you know, social media platforms have to be involved in. And obviously, I think the next step, and government agencies like DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, their purpose is basically to prepare America against potential threats at a technological level. And now in a digital age, one of the things that they're heavily investing into is, you know, how do we address concerns around, you know, disinformation? And in 2015, they started a program called Metaphor. It stands for Media Forensics. And the idea is that, well, now we have all the tools that allows us to manipulate images, videos, multimedia. What can we do to detect those? And mm-hmm. at the same time, AI advanced so much, specifically in, you know, the area of deep learning, mm-hmm. where people can, you know, generate photorealistic content, Now they are taking this to another level and started a new program called Semaphore, which is semantic forensics.
You're not against the idea of deepfakes. You believe that deepfakes actually hold value. You've said this before. Can you explain that a little bit?
I mean, a deepfake is a very scary word, but I would say that the underlying technology is actually important. It has a lot of positive use cases, especially in the area of communication. If we ever wanted to have immersive communication, we need to have the ability to generate photorealistic appearances of ourselves in order to enable that. For example, in the fashion space, that's something that we're working on. Imagine if you ever wanted to create a digital twin of yourself and you wanted to see yourself in different clothings and do online shopping, really virtualizing the entire experience. Mm. And deepfakes specifically are focusing on video manipulations, which is not necessarily the primary goal that we have in mind.
As a creator and developer, do you feel any obligation to play a role in combating the use of deepfakes for spreading disinformation?
First of all, we develop these technologies for creating, for example, avatars, right? Which is one thing that, you know, we're demonstrating with our startup company called Pinscreen. Mm-hmm. And the deepfakes are sort of like a derivative from it, right? We were all caught by surprise. We were like, wow, now you have these capabilities now. And we really have an additional responsibility in terms of what are the applications. And this goes beyond our field. This is an overall concern in the area of artificial intelligence.
So it's going to take everyone.
In some ways, yes.
That's Hao Li. He is Associate Professor of the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technologies. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, people in Houston are gathering today for the funeral of Deputy Sandeep Dhaliwal. He was the first person of the Sikh faith to serve in the Sheriff's Office of Harrods County. Last week, he was shot during a traffic stop. Deputy Dhaliwal was known as a generous man who wore a turban and a full beard on duty. His death is being investigated.
With just 29 days until the deadline, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says it's time to get Brexit done. He told the Conservative Party conference in Manchester in the UK today that he plans to take the UK out of the European Union October 31st, come what may.
We must have a new relationship with the EU, a positive and confident partnership, and we can do it. And today in Brussels, we are tabling what I believe are constructive and reasonable proposals.
Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson, who's at that party conference in Manchester. Rob, this speech was billed as Johnson's final offer to the EU. What are these constructive and reasonable proposals?
He is asking the EU to make some big, fat concessions. There's no two ways about it, Jeremy. I mean, if you think about the EU's single market and customs union, the single market is about making sure that regulations are all the same across the 28 countries. So it doesn't matter whether you're a cow or a car, you just go over the border, no bother at all. And there's also a customs union. And what that means is that, you know, there are no customs barriers internally in the EU, but you all have the same trade policy towards the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And what Mr. Johnson is saying is, look, everybody wants to avoid a border in Northern Ireland. We can't do that entirely, but what about Northern Ireland sort of stays in that regulatory bit, but not in the customs union, so as the UK can have its own trade policy. But we'll make sure that any sort of customs checks on the island of Ireland, as it's referred to, are as light touch as possible.
As light touch as possible. So you could move back and forth between Northern Ireland and Ireland with goods, and they wouldn't really look very closely into the truck or what?
Well, they haven't spelt that out. Right. But interestingly, you see, some people who were involved in the negotiation of the Good Friday Peace Agreement in Northern Ireland say, do you know what? All of this stuff that Mr. Johnson is talking about, minimising customs, misses the point that what that agreement was about. And of course, many people in the United States, particularly of Irish heritage, were concerned deeply about this agreement, that it was actually about identity. And that is that if you're in the north of Ireland, whether you sort of wanted to feel British or Irish or both, whether you were Catholic or Protestant, you could feel whatever you liked. And that the whole point about this problem with Brexit and, you know, whether cows are going to be prodded or not prodded or cars or whatever slightly misses the point that just any form of making, you know, the movement of goods, people, or anything else in Ireland more difficult will be sort of harmful to the spirit, if not the letter of the law, of the Good Friday Agreement.
Now, Rob, the EU has not been inclined to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement, which was worked out over a long period of time with the former Prime Minister, Theresa May. Is there any expectation that the EU is now open to Johnson's suggestions?
I think the short answer to your question has to be that things aren't looking good, which leads you to think that there are two theories about Mr. Johnson's approach. I mean, one is that he's just hoping that the EU is so desperate to avoid a no-deal Brexit and to just sort of get Brexit sort of settled that they will be prepared to make these astonishingly large compromises. I mean, the other theory is that Mr. Johnson knows that this hasn't got a catch chance in you know where of succeeding, and that therefore this is all about optics. This is, so let's say there's a no-deal Brexit, it'll all be the EU's fault. We made them a reasonable proposal, but those wretched people, those foreigners in Brussels, they weren't prepared to listen. So, you know, you've got one of those two theories.
Now, you talk about a no-deal Brexit. We should remind people, Parliament said very explicitly that Boris Johnson cannot take the UK out of the EU without a deal on October the 31st, that he'd have to ask for an extension. So why are we still talking about a no-deal Brexit?
It's a very good question because, you know, Mr. Johnson keeps on saying we're going out on the 31st of October, which, let me round it all up in this way, because I'm sure people just want to know, get that idiot to shut up and just tell us what's going to happen with Brexit. So I'd put it like this. You know, the big question in British politics is, first of all, is there a chance of the EU and the UK striking a deal between now and the 30th of October? It's kind of looking unlikely. That then moves us on to this question that you've raised, Jeremy, so, which is this. You know, is Mr. Johnson really serious about taking Britain out of the EU without a deal, even though that has been ruled out by an Act of Parliament? And then it seems to me the big question is, well, you know, if he is, will Parliament really be able to stop him? And I think that is the big question, the sort of two big questions in British politics. And then let's say the politicians do prevent him from taking Britain out with a no-deal Brexit. Well, then what happens? Well, I guess there would be an extension to the Brexit process. And then at that point, you have to have the big democratic event, either a referendum, a general election, or who knows, Jeremy, both.
Do you think that no matter what happens, that those things will happen in November, December, that there will be an election, that there might even be another referendum?
I think it's almost certain as anything could be in the topsy world of crazy Brexit Britain. I think it's almost certain that there will have to be a general election. Things are unsustainable as they are. Whether there would be a referendum, I think it just depends possibly on who wins a general election or whether politicians decide, do you know what, we're in a horrible mess over Brexit, and although a second referendum would be horrible, let's try and do that and then have a general election.
That's BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joining us from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester in the UK. Rob, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy. But that was all clear then.
All cleared up. And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.